Anyone who has given any thought to the matter will understand that the difference between 15 and 16 is hard to pinpoint with the naked eye. I have known 14-year-olds who look like they're 20, and 17-year-olds who could pass for 12. Yet, for the legal system, the distinction between 15 and 16 is crucial and enormous. And woe to the man who finds himself on the wrong side of that line.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, Tom Perata reads from his new novel, The Abstinence Teacher. Perata is best known for his novel, Election, which was adapted into a movie. Here he returns to the delicious metaphor of an American public high school, which stands in for a country in the throes of culture war. Perata delicately explores the friction in a sex education class in a suburb. It could be your own. This reading of The Abstinence Teacher took place in November 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. Listeners, be warned, the audio contains some frank sexual language.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming out. The Abstinence Teacher is a novel about the culture war in this one suburban town. And it starts when a sex ed teacher, sort of liberal feminist sex ed teacher named Ruth Ramsey, makes a remark about oral sex in her classroom that's, depending upon your perspective, completely innocuous or really scandalous. And there's an activist evangelical church in her town that uses this remark to kind of create a controversy and pressure the school administration into changing the curriculum to abstinence only. And Ruth is not too happy about this and occasionally sort of undermines the curriculum while she's teaching. And as a result, ends up in a special sort of re-education seminar. And I'll read to you a little bit from that. It's called Refresher. Roger, a 60-ish gym teacher with an iron gray crew cut, smiled as he smeared cream cheese on a rubbery bagel. "Hey," he said, "it's just like the Breakfast Club, except they actually provide breakfast." Ruth didn't know for a fact that Roger was a gym teacher, but it seemed like a safe bet, given that he was wearing those high-waisted polyester shorts favored by coaches of a certain age, and a t-shirt that read, "Property of West Highland Eagles." CJ, the mannish lesbian standing next to Ruth, gave an appreciative snort. Ruth didn't know for a fact that CJ was a lesbian, but she had yet to meet a straight woman who thought it was a good idea to dress like the lead singer in Sha Na Na. "Yeah," CJ said, "you get treated real nice here. Just stay away from the Kool-Aid." There were four of them in all: Roger, CJ, Ruth, and Tricia, an earnest young woman who'd brought along her own supply of herbal tea bags. Standing around a folding table in the regional headquarters of Wise Choices for Teens in downtown Lakeview. "I don't know what you're talking about," Roger told CJ. "I drank the Kool-Aid and it had no effect whatsoever on me. I just happen to firmly believe that sex is bad and my penis is an instrument of the devil." He paused, looking momentarily puzzled. "No, wait, it's my wife who thinks that." "Well, she's at least half right," CJ quipped. Tricia sipped her wellness tea and studied the poster pinned to the wall above the copy machine. It showed a horrified college boy backing out of a dorm room, trying to escape the clutches of a seductively dressed, otherwise lovely co-ed who had HIV+ stamped on her forehead in bold black letters. "If only it were this easy," declared the headline at the top of the poster. A smaller caption at the bottom read, "Abstinence, because you never really know." "This place gives me the creeps," she muttered. "What did you do?" CJ asked her. Tricia turned away from the poster. She was a short, plump woman with dark hair and a pretty mouth. If not for her serious intellectual eyeglasses, she could have easily been mistaken for a college student herself. "I admitted to my students that I masturbate," she said, sounding mortified and defiant at the same time. It wasn't like it was part of the lesson plan or anything. we were just talking in a general way, and I said that most people probably did at one time or another in their lives, and that it was nothing to be ashamed about. And then this boy asked me point blank if I had ever done it myself. "Oops," said Roger. "I know." Trisha's face flushed pink. I should have just told him it was none of his business, but it seemed cowardly. I mean, I tell them all the time that I want my classroom to be a safe place where people can talk openly about every aspect of sexuality and ask any question they want. "And look where it got you," CJ said. "What about you, Ruth?" "My story's not so interesting," Ruth told her. "I just lost my head and suggested that there might be some problems with our handouts from the Jerry Falwell Institute of Disinformation." "Hear, hear," said Roger. "I'm a repeat offender," CJ volunteered. "They made me come last spring for the same reason I'm here now. Because I don't care what the goddamn curriculum says. Abstinence until marriage can't possibly apply to gay and lesbian people until we're allowed to get married. Sentencing someone to a life without sex is cruel and unusual punishment." "Tell that to my wife," said Roger. "What about you?" Trisha asked Roger. She seemed to have relaxed a bit now that her secret was out. "What's your sin?" Roger shook his head. "I'd rather not talk about it." "That's not fair," CJ told him. "We all fessed up." "Whatever," Roger said. "If you really want to know, I showed my kids a Playboy centerfold. Miss April, 1973. "Why'd you do that?" Ruth asked. "That was stupid," he said. I was trying to make a point about fake tits." CJ looked bewildered. "What's that got to do with the curriculum?" Roger cupped his hands beneath his pectorals and gently lifted up. "I just like them natural," he said. Ruth and Trisha exchanged queasy glances. "Something I feel strongly about," Roger explained. "Don't even get me started." Joanne Marlowe was her usual perky, overdressed self, as if she couldn't imagine a better way to kick off the weekend than to throw on a tailored silk blouse, a tasteful string of pearls, and 3 coats of makeup before heading over to the office to knock some sense into a bunch of reprobate sex education teachers. "Good morning," she said, once they'd all taken their places around the big table in the conference room. "It's nice to see you all." Joanne flashed a brilliant smile at her captive audience and didn't seem the least bit put out when it wasn't returned. "Before we start, just let me say that I'm well aware of the fact that these special Saturday reinforcement sessions aren't very popular. Some of the teachers who've been invited here in the past have been pretty vocal about that on their evaluation sheets. Some have said they felt like they were being punished. Others have used words like indoctrination and total waste of time. Maybe some of you share these sentiments. If that's the case, all I can tell you is get over it." Joanne rolled her chair away from the table and stood up. She wasn't particularly tall, but there was something elegant and powerful in the way she carried herself, a quality of absolute confidence that Ruth couldn't help envying, even though it was completely foreign to her and deeply off-putting. "The first thing you need to remind yourselves," Joanne continued, "is that you're here for a simple reason. You did something wrong. Maybe it was an honest mistake, maybe it wasn't. I can't look into your hearts, and I don't know that I'd want to if I could. At the very least, I think it's safe to say that everyone here this morning is having a little trouble adjusting to a new way of thinking, and I want to help you fix that." She strode over to the board and wrote the words "great opportunity" in squeaky red marker. "So instead of feeling sorry for yourselves and resentful of me," she said, "I think you'd all be better served by adjusting your attitudes right now before we start. As hard as it might be for some of you to believe, this is a great opportunity for us to reconnect with our shared goal, which is to teach the Wise Choices curriculum to our students as enthusiastically and effectively as possible." None of the teachers nodded, but none of them protested either. And that seemed to be good enough for Joanne. "Great," she said. "What I'd like to do is start off with some autobiographical writing." Ruth stared at her exam book and tried yet again to focus her thoughts. So far, the only words she'd written were a restatement of the assignment Joanne had given them before stepping out of the room. "A sexual encounter I regret." By now, enough time had passed that this simple phrase had become the center of an elaborate solar system of doodled objects. stars and crescent moons and sinuous vines, a palm tree and a pair of sexy lips, the Eiffel Tower and a fish wearing sunglasses. It wasn't that she was stumped for something to write about. Like everyone else her age, Ruth had committed her share of youthful and not-so-youthful indiscretions. There were a couple of tipsy one-nighters in college she would have taken back if she could, as well as an ill-considered fling with a married, much older grad school professor that had fizzled after a lackluster session on the office couch. And she certainly regretted her weekend in the Poconos with Ray Mattingly, not because it had gone badly, but because it had gone so well, and because she'd humiliated herself by weeping inconsolably when he broke the news that he was moving. And then, of course, there was her ex-husband, Frank. They'd had some good times early in the marriage and brought two beautiful children into the world. But from where she sat now, it was hard to feel anything but sorry about that whole misguided era of her life. They'd stayed married for at least 4 years after they both knew it was over. And during that time, they continued to sleep together out of some pathetic combination of need, habit, and wishful thinking. If she counted all that, then she had no choice but to admit that she regretted most of the sex she'd ever had, and thinking that way made her even more depressed than she'd been when she woke up in the morning. CJ volunteered to be the first reader. "Ever since I've been aware of myself as a sexual being," she began, "I've known that I am a lover of women." "Me too," Roger chuckled. But CJ silenced him with an imperious glare. "When I was a teenager, this knowledge frightened me, implying as it did a lonely, outcast life lived on the fringes of quote-unquote normal society. Growing up in small-town, red-state America in the 1970s, I was as yet unaware that there were vibrant communities of women just like me, supportive, loving, beautiful, strong dykes of every race, creed, and color. And even if I had, I'm not sure I would have had the courage to imagine myself living among them. All I really did in high school was muddle through, biding my time until I could sneak off to college and figure out who I was without my parents, siblings, neighbors, and everyone else I knew looking over my shoulder, ready to mock me for any deviation from the so-called norm. Scoff if you must, but even today, in this supposedly enlightened country, there are places where it isn't safe to be a gay teen, not just physically, but mentally, spiritually." Joanne tapped the table. "We get your point, CJ. Can we just skip ahead to the part where you're actually responding to the assignment?" "I'm sorry," CJ said, in a voice oozing with insincere apology. "Am I making you uncomfortable?" "Not at all," Joanne replied. "I just appreciate it if you picked up the pace." "Fine." CJ flipped forward a couple of pages. "Okay, here it is. So, what's a confused young dyke to do when a boy asks her to the prom?" "All I can tell you is that I found it very difficult to say no. I had 4 close girlfriends at the time, and they all had dates. Plus, they were all going to Lori Welker's lake house after the prom, and I didn't want to miss out. It was our senior year, and they were my whole life, those girls. You can probably imagine how happy my mother was, her butch little girl dressing up like a princess on the big night. She put makeup on me and stuffed me into a frilly dress. I felt sick about it, sick and dishonest, but there I was. My date was a boy named Donnie, and he wasn't so bad. He didn't care about me one way or the other. He just wanted to be part of the fun. One thing we had in common, we both liked our southern comfort, and we both liked to dance when we were drunk. So the prom itself was actually a pretty cool experience. The after party was when things got weird. We hung out as a group for a while, but then the couple started to drift off, one by one, looking for private places. And finally, it was just me and Donnie, and we were trashed. CJ paused to gather her courage. "You asked me why I let him have sex with me, and I guess I could hide behind that as an excuse. Say I was just too drunk to resist. And maybe there's a little truth in that, but only a little. I think deep down, I was just praying that I would like it. That Donnie would do what the prom and the rest of my life hadn't. Turn me into a good little straight girl like everyone else. I guess you want to know what it was like for me. It was disgusting and painful and humiliating. Sobering, too. If there was one last shred of doubt in my mind that I was queer, Donnie Bulger knocked it right out of me on prom night. CJ smiled sadly, running her fingers through her slick back hair. As everyone here has probably guessed, I'm not a big fan of abstinence. I believe that we human beings have been put on this earth to love and worship one another to the best of our abilities and inclinations, regardless of our sexual orientation or marital status. But I will say this, for as long as I live, I'll think back to that awful night in 1979 and wish to God I had abstained. Pardon me, I'm skipping a little bit here. Thank you, CJ, Joanne said. It was a very interesting piece. I think you put your finger on a couple of really important issues that some of us might want to address in the classroom. One is the link between alcohol abuse and self-destructive sexual behavior, and the other is prom night peer pressure. A couple of schools I know have gone so far as to set up sobriety checkpoints at their proms, complete with breathalyzers and police officers, and I think your essay goes a long way in showing why that might not be such a bad idea. That wasn't my point at all, CJ protested. What I object to is the mandatory heterosexuality at the prom, all those smug straight people rubbing it in everyone else's face. That's what led to my self-destructive behavior. One thing the rest of you might want to consider, Joanne continued, is encouraging parents in your communities to sponsor chaperoned after-parties in their homes. If you go to our website, you'll find a list of recommended group activities that'll help keep the kids out of trouble and restore some of the lost innocence back to prom night. Nude twister, muttered Roger. Joanne stared at him in disbelief. How old are you? She asked. Old enough not to give a crap, he replied. Ugh, Joanne grimaced. I can't believe they let you teach children. Not only that, Roger told her, they gave me tenure. I feel sorry for your students, Joanne said. She looked like she was about to say something more, but decided it wasn't worth the trouble. Let's just move on. Tricia, would you like to go next? With obvious trepidation, Tricia glanced down at her composition. It's kind of embarrassing, she said. That's all right, Joanne said. We're not here to judge you. We just want to hear what you have to say. I'm really ashamed of myself, Tricia murmured. Excellent, Joanne said. Why don't you tell us about it? So in the interest of time, I will skip Tricia's memory, but you'll find out about it. Joanne stared at Tricia with a look that teetered between pity and contempt. Ew, she said. I can't believe you had sex with your best friend's fiancé while she was in the house. It was just that once, Tricia explained in self-defense. It never happened again. Personally, Roger interjected, I can't believe he kissed your foot. That's what's really gross. It was clean, Tricia informed him. I'm pretty careful about that. Joanne ignored this, still staring doggedly at Tricia. Did you tell Eve what you'd done? She inquired. I meant to, Tricia confessed. But it was so close to the wedding, and I was maid of honor. It just seemed awkward. I hope you're kidding me, Joanne said. I hope you didn't stand up at the altar next to the woman you betrayed. There wasn't an altar, Tricia told her. The ceremony was in a French restaurant. You were the maid of dishonor, Roger said with a chuckle. That was my punishment, Tricia said, her voice trembling slightly, to know that I'd been a terrible friend. What about Thad? Ruth asked. Did you ever talk to him about it? Just that night, Tricia replied. We made a pact to forget what we'd done, to pretend it never happened. And that's pretty much what we did, except that every now and then, when I'm over their house and Eve leaves the room, he gives me this weird little smile. Sometimes he winks. It's horrible. I think you should tell her, CJ said. You've got to clear the air. She shouldn't stay married to a creep like that. Let her get out now, before they have kids and everything gets complicated. Tricia winced. It's too late. Eve's pregnant. She asked me to be the godmother. Yuck, Joanne said. I can't listen to this. Who wants to go next? Me, Roger said, unless Ruth wants to. That's okay, Ruth told him. I can wait. Fine, Joanne said, with an audible lack of enthusiasm. Let's hear from Roger. Roger looked around the table, smiling at each member of his audience, making a preliminary claim on their goodwill. After clearing his throat and cracking his knuckles, he picked up the composition book and began to read. Anyone who has given any thought to the matter will understand that the difference between 15 and 16 is hard to pinpoint with the naked eye. I have known 14-year-olds who look like they're 20, and 17-year-olds who could pass for 12. Yet, for the legal system, the distinction between 15 and 16 is crucial and enormous, and woe to the man who finds himself on the wrong side of that line. I accept this. Many laws, such as speed limits, rely on arbitrary numbers, and we all do our best to obey them. But who's really to blame when a teenager claims to be an age she isn't? The deceiver or the deceived? Roberta was a camp counselor. You know what, Joanne said, raising her voice above Roger's. Why don't you just stop there? Thanks. Thank you. Thanks. So I'd be happy to take questions. Apparently there are mics there and there. You have to get up, so it's going to take some an act of volition. Thank you.
In the book, it seems like from the title and the whole first part of it, Ruth is sort of the focus. And then there's some place where you shift and all of a sudden you realize it's Tim's story. Or it seems like that way, at least to me. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Right. I mean, this section is all about Ruth. And one of the two main plot lines is you know, Ruth's journey as a sex education teacher forced to teach abstinence. And the first 100 pages basically is about that. And what happens is she's looking for a way to kind of fight back because she feels like she's been steamrolled by this church. And she gets her chance when she goes to her daughter's soccer game, and she sees that the daughter's coach, who belongs to the church, is leading the girls in prayer. And her first encounter with the coach, he seems like a kind of doctrinaire, hardline evangelical Christian. And then the book stops, and there's about 100 pages explaining who this guy is and how he got to the church. And he turns out to be a more complicated figure than he originally seems to Ruth. And it's true. I think I don't plan books out when I start them, and I kind of feel my way through them. And I think, in a way, that second 100 pages, it's weird. Like the plot kind of stops, and it's all just background about Tim. And I think in the course of writing that, I found myself becoming really interested in, I mean, he's a guy with a drug and alcohol problem. He's a guy with a broken family. He's trying to get back on his feet, and he's really feels loved and welcomed by this church, and feels a real personal connection with the pastor, who's a kind of charismatic and difficult figure. And I think it's somehow or other, you know, the logic of fiction is the dynamic character kind of steals the narrative. And you know, Ruth, a lot of things happen to Ruth, but her core kind of is intact throughout the book. But Tim is, you know, constantly tiptoeing along this abyss. And, you know, really the whole sort of second half of the book is about decisions that he has to make. So it's true that in a way I completely didn't expect it became his book. And it's, you know, titles are funny because I do think it might maybe seem a little misleading to call it The Abstinence Teacher, in the sense that that suggests that it's simply Ruth's book. But I feel like, you know, Ruth is not the abstinence teacher. She's the person who doesn't want to be the abstinence teacher. And that phrase somehow, to me, signifies the entire battle that includes Tim and connects her to him. So, but I think your observation is absolutely true. And to me, it's like those sort of surprises in the course of writing the book are what gets a writer through a novel. Just the things that you find out, the things that you don't know. Tim was also the real challenge for me, in the sense that I'm not an evangelical Christian, and I really felt like I needed to kind of enter that world and portray it from the inside. And so, you know, if I think about this book as, you know, a kind of just a challenge for me personally, it was to make his character believable. So, thanks.
Well, many of your more recent books have been made into movies, and I think you received an Academy Award nomination for co-writing Little Children. How has the possibility of having your books, like, optioned become movies, changed the book writing process for you?
Yeah, thanks. In exactly the way you might not expect, I think. I think that I was always a writer who filmmakers found they could read my work and kind of see the movie, because the stories are written very clearly, and they're pretty tightly constructed. They're not really long, and they're written kind of scenically. You know, I do write in a kind of scene by scene way. You could see from the section that I read. But after Election was made, I started to write screenplays. And in the course of doing that, what it actually taught me was how much freedom I had in the novel to, you know, move around in time, to get into the characters' heads and show them thinking, you know, exactly the kind of thing that really is difficult to get onto the screen. And so I you know, personally feel like if you look at the three books that I've written, you know, since I started writing screenplays, Joe College, Little Children, and The Abstinence Teacher, I think they're actually less cinematic and more literary than the books that came first. And it was really me kind of realizing that I had certain tools at my disposal as a novelist, and really wanting to use them to their fullest.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Bob. Nice to see you.
Yeah, same here. So you've had this like slow progression from Bad Haircut and like obscurity to where you are now, where you're
a higher grade of obscurity.
Yeah, right. No, like, you know, now like you write a book and every major book outlet feels obliged to at least comment on it. So my question is, how weird is that?
It's very weird, Bob. And thanks for asking that. I tell you what I have felt, and I hate to be one of those whiny writers, you know, is I was always kind of an underdog until this book, I always felt. And so critics would sort of champion my work. And I did feel with this one that there were a few people who felt some need to, like, take a swipe. So I'm, you know, late at night when I'm pondering this, I tell myself it's a backhanded compliment, but my face still hurts. Yeah.
Your scenes set in teacher staff rooms, and just when you write about education in general, are like brilliant. Do you have any experience working in high schools or anything like that?
No, you know, it's interesting. I have two good friends who are high school teachers, and I hear a lot from them. I taught in college myself for a number of years. But yeah, I don't know what that is. I always feel like it was somehow like the life I didn't have, but could have had. So I'm glad it rings true. Are you a teacher?
Former teacher.
Yeah.
We are legal now.
Oh, good. Well, I'm always happy if it rings true for people who've been through it. And I think I always sort of perk up when there are these dramas in the paper that involve school boards and teachers, and I like nothing better than the scenes in the local news when they have people sort of standing up in the town meeting room, you know, having their say. I just have heard a lot of stories set there, and I did my time in high school, and I think we all we're all scarred by, you know, we all carry that deep in us. Yeah.
Back to Election. When you wrote it seemed to me, and I could be off, that you tried to make all the characters have like really good attributes that you could identify with everybody. The movie was kind of the opposite. So my question to you is, when you look at the film, do you identify with any of the characters or none at all?
Yeah, well, that's actually a very, very good point. I would say I learned a lot from the movie versions of my books. I think with Election, Alexander Payne really heightened the satire. And he just really let it rip. So, for instance, the character Paul in my book is a smart high school football player who's discovering that he has more depth than he realized, and his running for president is an attempt to kind of expand his horizons and be somebody maybe more complicated and bigger than he was before. And in the movie, he's just a sweet, dumb jock. So that's a big difference. And I think it's much easier for me to identify with Paul in the book than in the movie. The one character that I identified most with was Tammy. And I identify with her equally in the movie. She's sort of intact in the movie. Even Tracy is, I think, more sympathetic in the book as well. But I think that was a good lesson, because I'm not at all upset with the movie version. I think it's basically he went for funny and it turned out funny. So it's like a completely successful artistic move, I think. And I feel like Todd Field did something similar with Little Children, just in the opposite direction. You know, he heightened the darkness that was in that novel and kind of minimized the humor, because that's just his, I think, sensibility as an artist. I think it's a brilliant film, but people who just see the movie, I think, would have no idea what it might be like to read that book, which is, you know, page by page, a pretty funny experience, I think. Whereas the movie has little flashes of humor, but, I saw it a lot last year. We went to various screenings, and, you know, it takes a toll on you.
Did you do research for this book on evangelical Christianity, on sex education, on the abstinence movement? And if so, what did you find that interested you?
That's a good question. This book did involve more research than usual for me, and a lot of it was about contemporary Christian culture. So I did some research that was really hands-on. You know, I went to church, went to a Promise Keepers rally. I read the Bible, which I probably should have done a long time ago, but didn't. And I spent a lot of time on the web. There's just this vast kind of Christian virtual world, where people are blogging about their faith or giving advice. And, you know, one of the things I found, and has been incorporated into the book, was, this whole, world of Christian sex advice. And it really fascinated me, because on the one hand, they're sort of preaching very strict abstinence to, you know, people before marriage, but they're also sort of holding out this idea of a really vitally and adventurously sexual marriage. And so I was sort of startled, because I come out of a kind of Catholic tradition where, you know, it's always, you know, basically the line is any sexual act would be open to procreation, so that does limit the variety. Whereas, you know, within this evangelical world, you know, basically there are these sites that would say, you know, we're going to go at it this way. As long as it's not explicitly prohibited in Scripture, consider that it's okay. And so they just go down this long list of you know, sexual acts and just say, you know, this it seems fine. We can't see anything suggesting that you can't do this or that, you know. So basically it got down to, you know, if there wasn't a third party involved, you know, or an image, you know, so you couldn't, like, look at pornography or, you know, if you wanted to get some sexy costume for your wife, for example, that was fine as long as you didn't order it from a website where another woman was modeling it. And there's something in there where you could do a lot of role-playing, but only if within the role-playing scenario, you were married. So it'd be like, you know, I think in there it's, you know, you're the doctor, I'm the patient, but we just happen to have gotten married before your appointment. Now, one of the things that struck me as very funny was I said some of this in a New York Times article, and immediately got about five emails from angry Catholics who felt that I had... It was the way that I said it. I think I was just speaking off the cuff, and basically I was just trying to talk about this issue of sexual variety. But I think the quote made it sound like I was suggesting that there was no emphasis on sexual pleasure in Catholicism, and people were unhappy with that. And it seemed like a real sore spot. You know, they wanted to just say, look, there's a whole Catholic theology of sexual pleasure that you're, you know, you just don't seem to be aware of. But then the evangelicals on their website had some article called Sexy Evangelicalism, and they were very happy about what I'd said. And I just hadn't realized that there was this competition as to who's the sexiest Christian denomination. Yes?
It sort of follows your point, but are there any either evangelical or political groups that have sort of wanted you to champion their cause on either side or any side, both with this and Little Children? And then the second question, I was just curious if Todd Fields did a good job of interpreting your interpretation of Madame Bovary, because it was such a new view. Usually people talk about her in reference to sort of borderline personality, or it was sort of refreshing not to have her over-psychologized, and I was just curious if it was accurate with your depiction of her in the book.
Yeah. Todd and I, wrote the script together, and that scene is based very closely on a scene in the book. What's great about that scene, I think, is that ultimately has very little to do with Madame Bovary. It's the character kind of using this external work to kind of frame her own behavior in heroic terms. And I think that's, a really interesting kind of literary criticism. We read to help us rationalize our desires. But I really like that scene for that reason. I thought that it really felt like the book to me, and it also cinematically was really interesting in the way that it sort of flashed on some of the sex scenes. Because a lot of times in movies, sex scenes are distracting or dull or just creepy. But because it was those they were just flashes, and they were sort of commenting on the scene where she was commenting on Madame Bovary, it became this very multi-layered sequence, and I really liked the way that it worked. As for the first question, I haven't, aside from this brief flurry of, it seemed like a kind of concerted effort on the part of certain, like a lot of the Catholics who contacted me were contacting me as people who were connected to some organizations, and I think they saw it as their job to kind of publicly set the record straight. Aside from that, I only hear from individual readers speaking as individuals, and I've heard from sex education teachers, and I've heard from Christians, and I expected in a way a lot more flack than I've gotten, which is sort of, I think just says something interesting about this book. I started it in 2004 when it seemed to me like the culture war was just at this kind of pitch that is hard to remember now. It seemed like, George Bush was mainly reelected by, values voters in swing states, people who had been mobilized by the specter of gay marriage. And it seemed crazy at that point in time, especially for me. I live in Massachusetts. Gay marriage is legal. It's just sort of a fact of life for us. There really was just a sense of, like, this country is so bitterly divided and people just live in different realities. And in a way, I was trying to respond to that feeling in writing the book. And 3 years later, it just seems like some kind of fever has broken. There just doesn't seem to be the level of just this level of doctrinaire, pitched combat between the two camps. Or else people just ignore fiction. that's another way to look at it. But I do feel like the culture wars have quieted down, and there's some sense that, our obsession with issues of sexual morality had sort of crowded out a lot of other really important issues that had sort of snuck up on us.
Thanks for coming to do this reading for
us. Oh, my pleasure.
It seems like in 2004, your interest really came from this American culture war, as you describe it. Were there any specific events or things that happened in that year that really catalyzed this particular interest in abstinence-only education for you?
It was interesting because I really did, I think, start with the broader impulse, which was to write about the culture war from both sides. I'm very interested in this idea of fiction as microcosm, trying to get in a small-scale drama I set up a small-scale drama that somehow reflects a larger social drama. And so I think I could have done it around gay marriage. I think I could have done it around evolution / intelligent design. I could have done it around abortion. And I think, you know, for me personally, I think, first of all, I'm more interested in sex than in those other subjects. But second, I think it's more universal in the sense that everybody has to make sexual choices, first of all, before they're married, but also throughout their lives. And I think, you know, what sex education really is, I think, is a kind of an attempt to create like a cultural, the official cultural line about sex. And so basically everybody has this official line and then everybody has their private, somewhat secret life. And a lot of the book really is about, you know, here's Ruth, she's teaching is very, you know, pro-sex, you know, pleasure is good, shame is bad, kind of sex education. But actually she herself has had a very unsatisfying sex life. And here's Tim, who's trying to live this sort of straight and narrow Christian life, and he's been a musician in the past. He's had a much too colorful sex life, and even now that he's married, you know, there's constant temptation around him. And I was just very interested in the characters' sexual histories. And it seems like for novelists, that line between sort of what we say publicly and what we do privately, that's why the novel exists. It's the form that can, I think, be most honest about what goes on in private. I don't think people talk. Our culture's gotten more and more open, but I think, even so, I think people don't actually tell the truth about what it is they actually do and how their behavior measures up against their stated values. So sex education actually seemed to me more interesting for the reader and just seemed to have more potential as a subject for a novel. So I think I gravitated there. I think, I don't think there was any... I also think as I read more and more about the abstinence movement, I was sort of surprised at how much success they were having. Because at first it seemed to me like a completely misguided thing to try and convince American teenagers that this was a good idea. Because, you know, we'd had this sexual revolution and it just seemed like you weren't going to be able to get that genie back in the bottle. But they actually had a fair amount of success. And I was struck by that. And I was struck by the willingness of the right to sort of, fight that battle, because it seemed like a losing battle, and then they were doing pretty well on it. But I was also struck by this ambivalence about it, in that, as I mentioned with the hot Christian sex, there was this attempt to kind of to stop being the church lady shaking her finger saying, "Don't do that, don't do that." It was much more the sense that don't do it now, and your reward later will be really, really good sex that you will never have been hurt. Because there's this whole part of abstinence that sort of says that early sexual experience will only hurt you. You know, and if you go to abstinence rallies, you know, they'll do things like they'll take a chainsaw to a heart, you know, and you'll have this sort of, instead of an intact heart, you'll have this kind of, you know, beat up, hacked apart heart. And there's also this metaphor of the glue that holds two people together. But if you have sex with too many partners, your glue kind of gets dispersed. And so there's just this sense, you know, that most of us might have that, like, we learn from experience and bad relationships might teach us what a good relationship is, or, you know, that heartbreak is a kind of inevitable part of growing up or something. All that is, you know, really, they really struggle against that and just try and say, like, don't do it. You'll just get hurt. Save it for the right person. And somebody was saying, they grew up in the South in the past, and the old line was, you know, sex is filthy, disgusting, and immoral, and you have to save it for someone you love. And the new line is, you know, sex is beautiful, powerful, and wonderful, but don't even think about it. So, yeah, I was just struck by a lot of different parts of that subject.
Hi. I have to admit that I haven't read a lot of, modern literature outside of political literature, but I was really amazed, and I am amazed at how what is, you know, accepted to be said, like, in a novel or in modern literature, but yet, you know, all the old writers are still taught in school, and everyone, you know, in school we're taught these are the great works, you know. I just wanted to know if who of the, you know, old writers, like the English writers or whoever, you have been influenced by, if any, and how maybe their styles or, you know, what they've written has maybe worked into your work right now, considering that the cultures are, like, absolutely completely different, and, you know, writing style is very different now too.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really good question, and interestingly, you know, I think I'm very drawn to 19th century novels and maybe more French and Russian writers than English ones for some reason. Though I'm a big Henry James fan, there's no influence on me of Henry James, but I read him quite happily. The writers I've been more influenced by, you know, directly are much more contemporary writers. Raymond Carver, Ernest Hemingway. Early in my career, I wrote in a very kind of minimalist style that was kind of in the air in the 80s when I was sort of learning how to write. But I read a lot of 19th century novels and made a decision that was, like, you know, somewhat unusual, I think, for writers of my generation. Like, the ones who really got a lot of attention in the 90s were the sort of virtuoso postmodern writers, you know, really talented writers, but not ones who were necessarily interested in writing, you know, carefully plotted novels with characters who seemed real. So I really did embrace a kind of 19th century realism and have tried to stick with that throughout, though my writing, you know, though obviously we have all this freedom to say things that they didn't have. But other than that, I actually feel like, you know, there are probably things that we can't say that we don't even know we can't say because these restrictions go so deep. So in that sense, we're probably not even that different from them. There are cultural boundaries that tell us what we can and can't say, and we're always pushing against them. But, you know, there are definitely writers who are going way beyond what I think I can say. Yep.
Just sort of a quick follow-up question to the first one you got tonight. I'm interested in how two of your now six novels or six books have been about school, had it been about either schools or school-related issues. Why have you found your settings within that
school? Actually three, because Joe College is a college novel. And I actually think that maybe the key lies right there in Joe College. I went from a very sort of mediocre working class public high school to Yale. And Joe College is sort of about that move. And I think it really made me, once I did that, you know, it sort of changed me forever. And I felt like I sort of jumped into a different class when I did that. And I think, you know, most people aren't necessarily as aware of class unless you really feel like you've changed class. And what it made me realize, I went from a kind of very democratic, egalitarian space to a really elitist space. And that knowing that, you know, knowing that high school was sort of the last really egalitarian place I was, I think it exists in my mind as a kind of metaphor for America. It was sort of the last time that I wasn't sort of self-identified with this more elitist subset of America. So I do think when I write about high school, I think I'm writing about America. And I think it's like the one, I mean, aside from like the highways, you know, or the malls, it's like the one place. Even malls now are stratified. Like, you can go to the sort of the working class mall, or you can go to the, you know, the Ivy League mall. But even the highways are getting that way, right? You can, like, pay to go in the fast lane while the other people stay in the traffic jam. But I did feel like public high school is the best metaphor I can think of for America. Well, thanks so much. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.